The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Hello and welcome back to today's show. It's Justin Brierley hosting this season of the podcast with Alistair. Today, beginning a new conversation with him on C.S. Lewis, The Inklings, that's the group of friends he met with regularly in Oxford at the Eagle and Child, and also Lewis's thoughts on friendship generally, as spelled out in books like The Four Loves. Do rate and review this podcast if you can. It helps others to discover the show. People like Charlie, who wrote this: "This find has been a perfect complement to my journey into the Christian faith. I've realised that there is something more to life, and I've been determined to embrace God and build a clear understanding of the reasons why, and more importantly, how to take this path. C.S. Lewis was recommended to me by a great Christian friend, and it was sound advice. I've already started to read Mere Christianity, and this podcast is the perfect companion, particularly on my daily walk. What's more, C.S. Lewis, and indeed Alistair McGrath, delightful man to listen to, have a great deal more to share and help me in my exciting endeavour. I recommend this podcast to all who wish to learn more about the man, and indeed the Christian faith. Thank you." Gosh, couldn't ask for a more lovely review than that, Charlie. God bless you in your continuing Christian journey. So great to know that the podcast has been part of that. If you enjoy this, by the way, you may enjoy our other podcasts from Premier Unbelievable, the Ask N.T. Wright Anything podcast, which I sit down with New Testament scholar N.T. Wright on a regular basis to ask the questions you send in, and my Unbelievable show as well, where we bring Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate. By the way, if you want more from this show, it's cslewispodcast.com you're looking for. We're shortly, though, going to be unveiling a brand new website, bringing all of our podcasts from Premier Unbelievable into one place. Very exciting. Watch this space for more news. And if you want to support the show for the rest of the year from anywhere in the world, you can find links to do that with today's podcast. Hope you enjoy today's conversation. Welcome along to another edition of the podcast. Always a great pleasure to sit down with Alistair McGrath to talk all things C.S. Lewis. I'm a huge fan of C.S. Lewis myself, and occasionally get the opportunity to return to Oxford, Alistair, and walk the streets. Did that a couple of months ago, and was walking down the road where the Eagle and Child is, which was one of the favourite haunts, of course, of Lewis and the Inklings, and was rather concerned to see it wasn't open. And from what I can gather, sort of effectively closed down during the lockdown. Do you know anything about the fate of that well-known landmark and pub in Oxford?
Well, I do. It's still closed down. I mean, and we're not quite sure what its future is. I mean, there are two pubs that are very important for Lewis. There's the Eagle and Child. There's also the Lamb and Flag just across the road, where they moved actually in the late 1950s because they got fed up with the Eagle and Child. And it's also closed. And I think it's partly due to the pandemic. I think it's also because they're considering redeveloping the site. But I'm told that they hope the Eagle and Child will reopen. But if you want to visit Oxford to specifically go to the Eagle and Child, I suggest you give them a call first and make sure it's going to be open.
Yes, yes. I mean, for many fans of Lewis and Tolkien, indeed, you know, it would be a crying shame if the pub didn't reopen in some form. You know, you can. I know when it was open, you could sit at, you know, more or less the same part of the pub, maybe not the exact table that Lewis sat at, but, you know, there's a blue plaque and everything else to mark the moment. And I know it's very much part of the C.S. Lewis tourist trail. Well, let's hope that that it does, you know, reopen. I think I saw some sort of notice suggesting that there was some sort of brewery that it was changing hands into. Who knows? We'll see. Let's talk about Lewis and the Inklings, first of all. First of all, for those who don't know, tell us what the Inklings was, who it was comprised of, and what it was for.
Well, the Inklings was a kind of discussion and support group. It was basically originally Lewis and his brother, Warney and Tolkien, and it gradually expanded to include others. All men, I have to say. I mean, some books suggest that Dorothy L. Sayers was a member. She wasn't really, but she knew many of the people in the Inklings. And basically, I think it's best seen as a group which had two functions. One was social. They'd meet regularly in the Eagle and Child to chat. And then a more serious thing which took place on Thursday evenings, which is when they would meet as a group and talk about works that were under development. So if you like, meeting together to chat, meeting together seriously to talk about writings. And I think in my view, the Lord of the Rings is significantly shaped by some of those conversations. Not the Chronicles of Narnia. That was not discussed at the Inklings, although Lewis did once pass round the proofs of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe at the social meeting of the group, but they didn't actually discuss that particular set of books.
So just tell us who was part of this circle. As you say, all male, and perhaps that's, you know, just a fact of the kind of society, culture, you know, the Oxford academia that Lewis moved in at the time. But who were the typical members that made up the Inklings over the years?
Obviously, there's Lewis himself. Now, Lewis had a brother, Warney. And Warney actually is a very significant person in his life. And really, this plays into the whole nature of friendship, actually, because Lewis and Warney were very important for each other. They were both writers. Warney was very interested in French history and wanted to write on that theme. And then, of course, there was J.R.R. Tolkien, who Lewis had got to know. And then others began to drop in, Hugo Dyson. And then Charles Williams, of course, became a member during his time in Oxford. The Oxford University Press decided that they would move some people from their London office back to Oxford during the Second World War. Charles Williams was one of those. And he became a member of the Inklings during the Second World War. So basically, these are people who didn't just enjoy reading literature. They're people who wanted to write as well. I think the key thing to take away from this was a critical yet supportive group of people who all believed that Christianity was important, that literature was important, and saw themselves as trying to encourage each other to write and help each other write better. So if you like, it's a group of critical friends who would help each other in their writing vocations.
I mean, we'll talk about Tolkien in more length in a separate episode, but give us a little sort of thumbnail sketch of Hugo Dyson and Charles Williams and the sorts of writings, why Lewis counted them among his, you know, close friendship group, and what sort of influence they had on him.
Well, Hugo Dyson is not really a well-known figure. I think that the important point to appreciate is that actually Dyson played a very important role in helping Lewis come to Christianity, because this happened in September 1930, and when Dyson and Tolkien together had a long walk around Addison's Walk in Magdalen College, and that was actually really what moved Lewis towards coming to faith. So that's very, very important. Charles Williams, I think, is very well known. Charles Williams, I think, is often referred to as the third Inkling, Lewis being the first, Tolkien the second. Williams was a very able poet and novelist who was actually employed as a literary editor by Oxford University Press, but his real heart lay in actually writing stuff himself. And he wrote some very important works. For example, in Dante interpretation, he wrote The Figure of Beatrice, which has actually stood the test of time very well. So I think rather than go through all of them, the key point is all of them liked reading and they wanted to write as well. And the key point is to sharpen each other up, to encourage each other, and to provide a kind of group culture that would help each of them improve their game.
When they came to the Inklings, as you say, sometimes it was purely on a social level. You know, they would have been there, you know, with presumably their pints of ale, smoking pipes, and then bringing their latest, perhaps, manuscript or chapter of a book and so on. And what, you know, if you could imagine yourself, cast yourself into the Eagle and Child back then, what would the kind of conversation have looked like between them of an average evening, do you think, Alistair?
Well, I think, again, we need to come back to this point, that the meetings of the Eagle and Child were social. They'd be talking about what they were doing and things like that. And they might pass round proofs or something like that. But the serious literary discussions were over a pot of tea on Thursday evening. There was no alcohol. It was serious business.
Yeah.
And someone would read what they had written and others would critique it. And in my view, that was actually the very serious business. Now, sadly, that did not continue. I think that really, in the late 1940s, that aspect of the Inkling ceased, and it just became a social group who met on, I think it was Tuesday, and then they moved to Mondays, because Lewis had to go to Cambridge, so they had a Monday morning, and then Lewis go to Cambridge that afternoon. But the key point, again, is this importance of keeping in touch with each other, stimulating each other, which is really important. In my view, the Inklings is at its most important, late 30s, early 40s.
So those were certainly a group of friends that Lewis, you know,
enjoyed socializing with, and, you know, obviously had a great influence upon him, not least, you know, Dyson and Tolkien in his own conversion as well. Who were sort of, would you say, were Lewis's wider circle of friends, both in Oxford and beyond Oxford as well?
Well, I think that's a very good point, because very often we present Lewis as if he knew the people in the Inklings and that was it. But actually, he had quite a wide circle of friends in Oxford and beyond. So let's look at some of those. I think the one that stands out for me is Austin Farrer, who was based in Oxford, was a very interesting writer, partly philosopher, partly New Testament scholar, very important person in Lewis's life. In fact, he was one of the two witnesses at Lewis's civil wedding in Oxford in 1956 to Joy Davidman. So you can see he played a really important role. Now Farrer was a very able writer, and in fact, many would say that Austin Farrer took on C.S. Lewis's role as an apologist after Lewis's death. So I think that's an important point to make. But interestingly, Lewis also knew his wife very well. This was Catherine Farrer, who wrote detective novels. And actually, they're quite good detective novels. But there are also other people. I mean, Dorothy L. Sayers is very important. She and Lewis maintained a robust correspondence, which is actually very interesting. They didn't agree with each other on a lot of things, but they did agree on the importance of Christianity and the importance of literature as a means of, in effect, presenting Christianity. And of course, there was the poet Ruth Pitter, who actually many people thought Lewis might one day marry, but nothing came of that. So Lewis is very well connected. He has lots of friends, and they are people who, like him, enjoy Christianity, enjoy literature, and can see a way of bringing them together.
Hmm. And what form did that take? I mean, for instance, Dorothy L. Sayers, was it primarily a friendship that was conducted via letters because people didn't always have the opportunity to be together in person? And I know Lewis was, you know, a prodigious letter writer. So was that the way a lot of his friendships were maintained through writing letters?
A lot of them were maintained through letters. And I think in the case of Dorothy L. Sayers, that was certainly the case. And I think that, you know, this may strike us as being strange, but actually a lot of this friendship became very important during the Second World War, when travel was difficult within Britain. You know, there was rationing, the trains were not running as regularly as they might, people were not able to use cars because of petrol rationing. So actually, letters really were very, very important. And actually, Lewis stands in a long tradition of writers, going back to Erasmus, you know, where correspondence was a means of not simply keeping in touch, but developing ideas. So I think that we need to say how important Lewis's letters are, both as ways of helping us to understand him as a person, but also as a way of sharing those ideas with privileged people who he regards being important, who might be able to help him to fine-tune them.
And you've said in a previous podcast that you've somehow regretted that Lewis didn't keep a diary, because it would have been useful to know more about his life. But at least he did write an awful lot of letters. And the fact that we have been able to obviously accumulate a number of those helps to give us another sort of insight into his life and character and thinking, doesn't it?
It certainly does. And they are very interesting. The later ones are not that interesting, I have to say, because Lewis had to write so many of them that they weren't as long and reflective as some of the earlier ones are. But nevertheless, particularly during the period when Lewis is finding his own way during the 1920s, early 1930s, I think they are very, very important. If you like, as a window into Lewis's soul, what he's reading, what he's thinking, what he hopes to do, it's all very important stuff.
I mean, he keeps up correspondence as well, not just with his peers and contemporaries in academia, but also his childhood friends as well. I think Arthur Greaves is someone that he continues to sort of keep in touch with over the years. Tell us about some of those friendships from childhood. Which were the ones that sort of continued, as it were, for Lewis, and what did they mean to him?
Yeah, I think you already mentioned one of them, Arthur Greaves. The other, of course, is his brother Warnish. Let's talk about both of those, because they are very important. Arthur Greaves really is someone who Lewis came to know, I think, out of a sense of obligation. He knew that Arthur Greaves was ill. He went to visit him, not expecting to enjoy it, but because it was the sort of thing he felt he ought to do. And he found him reading in bed, and it was a book about myths of the Norsemen. And Lewis said, "Hey, do you like that?" And Greaves said, "Yeah." And that began the friendship. It was a very much friendship as sharing something really important. And of course, they developed a quite intimate relationship, which actually continued throughout their lives. Lewis's last letter to Arthur Greaves, written just before he died in 1963, is actually very, very moving in my view. It's a friendship that kept going over many years. And Lewis would say in his letters to Greaves things he would say to nobody else. So in that case, and I think in that case only, Lewis is really using a friend as a kind of sounding board. I've got a really big problem. What do you think I should do? And it's very, very revealing. And those letters were never meant to be published, but they were eventually. Mm-hmm. I think it's very, very important. Mm-hmm. With his brother, that's really interesting, because of course his brother played a very big role in Lewis's imaginative development, because they lived in this big house in Belfast, loads and loads of books lying everywhere, and they would play imaginative games. They would read these books. It was very, very important. And you could say that Warney, in effect, catalyzed Lewis's imaginative development. And of course, he also looked after his brother. They went to the same schools together. Warney was slightly older, but Lewis was sometimes around with him together at schools. And he kind of would be the older brother who looked after the younger brothers. And of course, they both served in the British Army during the First World War. And when Lewis was badly wounded, his brother made this amazing motorcycle journey across shell-pocked territory to try and find his brother and make sure he was okay. So they were really very important. In fact, actually, when they bought the kilns in Oxford, the kilns was where Lewis settled down in the 1930s. It was owned by Mrs. Moore, but Lewis and his brother had lifelong shares in the house. That in effect became a way of recreating their childhood and rekindling their joint interest in literature. So those were two very important people for Lewis.
I mean, many people just know Warney as, you know, Lewis's brother. What were his own interests? And, you know, I understand he was essentially a historian of sorts.
He was a historian, and he was very interested in French history, particularly 18th century French history. And that wasn't something that Lewis himself found particularly interesting, but it was an important subject. And in fact, Warney did write a book on that topic, and it got published, and it was one that was discussed by the Inklings. So you can see that this was important. I think the problem with Warney is that it's a very familiar pattern. The one who became who was a support for Lewis at many critical points during his early life became a burden in older age. And part of that's because Warney became alcoholic. And I think that Lewis found that very, very difficult to cope with. He really, in fact, acted as a carer for his brother. And that was, I think, a bit sad. But certainly it was a very important relationship, which, again, kept going right throughout his life.
I know that in childhood they developed a sort of imaginary world, I think that was called Boxen. Was this in any way a sort of, you know, early incarnation of what would become Narnia for Lewis in his later writings?
It's very tempting to see that. I mean, I've looked at the Boxen works, and you can see a rich imagination. And both Warney and Lewis in their childhood played around with these imaginary worlds, in which railways actually played quite an important role. And that was, I think, if you like, a stimulus to Lewis. But I have to say, he did leave Boxen behind quite quickly. It was this realization that the imagination was really important, that really emerged and then began to take different forms than those which he developed during his childhood.
And when it comes to Arthur Greaves, it was this common love of mythology and so on that sort of was the spark of their friendship initially. How did that friendship develop? I mean, we know, for instance, that in the end, I think Arthur Greaves was gay, and that he confided in Lewis about that to some extent. Again, none of this would either of them would have assumed would ever be made public. But what? How did that sort of play out in terms of their friendship and the way they encouraged and supported each other?
I think it meant that Lewis felt he could talk to Arthur Greaves about things that he couldn't talk about with anybody else, including his brother. And I think it's because they developed quite a close friendship during their time in Belfast. They're both about the same age. They would talk about erotic issues, we know that. They would talk about literature. So actually, there was a sense that we can share whatever we want to. And that's why when Lewis got involved in this quite complex relationship with Mrs. Moore, who was the mother of an officer cadet who was training with Lewis at Keble College in Oxford in 1917 to early 1918, I mean, really, that became quite an important issue because Lewis could talk to Arthur about the kind of issues he was facing here, that his complex relationship with this woman who seemed to be playing an increasingly important role in his life and actually would become something of a mother figure to him. And again, that was a very good example of a friendship where Lewis felt, here was someone who I can share these things with and seek advice, but I need to share things. And this is someone who really I can talk to about things that otherwise I just couldn't.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of the podcast. If you want more about the show, go to our show page, cslewispodcast.com. And if you want to support the show from anywhere in the world, you can find links with today's podcast. Next time, I'll be continuing this conversation with Alistair about C.S. Lewis and his friendships. Until then, God bless. See you next time.